This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're, of course, into family law, but we're focusing on domestic violence and restraining orders against abusers. My guests are coordinating attorney Emberly Cross of the Cooperative Restraining Order Clinic in San Francisco. My other guest is Judge Eugene Hyman of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, retired. And I think you'll find this a very interesting program. And those of you, by the way, who may be victims of domestic violence, I hope that when we do take some phone calls that you will join us with your question, your comment, whatever. And those of you who are abusers or have been accused of being an abuser, I hope that you too would join us with your comments on the program. For those of you who are familiar with this program, we are live in the Bay Area on this station. We are live on the internet at www.kalw.org for the full hour. We do record the first half hour, and we send it out to a number of stations in California on CD. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. And Emberly and Judge Hyman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Very much. Very nice to have you both here. Emberly, would you do this? Could you explain to us? I know there are a couple of different types of orders. One is a civil restraining order. Another one, there's a criminal order, which has a different context, a protective order. Could you explain this to us basically, please?
Sure. It gets confusing. In California, we have a lot of different kinds of restraining orders. And if it's confusing for the general public, imagine if you're a victim of domestic violence and you've just gone through some incident, trying to figure out what type of restraining order you need or what kind of case you're involved in gets very confusing. The type of restraining order that my office does happens in the family court, a domestic violence restraining order under the California's Family Code. And a restraining order typically is going to order that the restrained person can't have any contact at all with the protected person, no calling, no having somebody else call, no texting, no emails, nothing. Also that they physically stay away from the protected person. In San Francisco, for example, our stay away order would be 100 yards away. Mm-hmm. That's a circle that follows the protected person wherever she goes. If she's at the grocery store, a restaurant, at her friend's house, church, if the restrained person comes in that 100 yards, the burden is on the restrained person to turn around and get out of that 100 yard radius. 100 yards away from the person, any place the protected person lives, any place the protected person works. If the parties have children together, the judge is also going to make orders about child custody and visitation as part of the restraining order. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The criminal protective order happens in a completely different context. That's in a criminal case where the police have been involved, somebody's been arrested, the prosecuting attorney decides to press charges against that person. A criminal protective order is really designed to protect the case, to protect the integrity of the prosecutor's case. If you're the prosecutor, you don't want the defendant, the person who's accused of the crime, to be trying to talk a witness out of testifying against you. So the judge will make these criminal protective orders.
By the witness, you mean most likely the victim, the abused victim. Is that who you're referring to?
It is. Thank you.
Okay.
Because in a criminal case, the victim of the crime is not a party to the case. The mm-hmm. victim is just a witness in the case, the star witness,
yes.
right? Because they're the person
yes.
this happened to. Mm-hmm. But the parties in a criminal case are the people of the state of California versus the defendant, the person mm-hmm. accused of the mm-hmm. crime. Mm-hmm. And in a criminal protective order, the judge is going to order that the defendant can't have any contact with the victim and has to stay away from the victim. The judge cannot make orders about child custody and visitation in the criminal context.
So you can have, I presume, you can have both a family law civil action at the same time that there may be a criminal action. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Does your office get involved with that at all?
We help with the family law side of it, mm-hmm. and then we can also talk with folks about working with the district mm-hmm. attorney's office mm-hmm. and what the criminal case is going to look like.
Let me ask you this, if I may. With respect to the cases that you are handling in the family law court area, those have, I presume, for the most part, not involved the police. Is that correct?
No, a lot of ours have involved the police.
But the DA's office has chosen not to proceed with some kind of a prosecution? Is that basically it?
Actually, no. The DA's office might be prosecuting as well. And what I tell a victim of domestic violence is if the victim wants a restraining order, mm-hmm. not to rely on that criminal protective order, because that can actually go away at any time.
And how would it go away without the witness knowing about it?
If the criminal case gets dismissed by the prosecutor's office, then that criminal protective order goes away. Since mm-hmm. it's designed to protect the case, mm-hmm. if the case goes away, the criminal mm-hmm. protective order mm-hmm. goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we encourage folks to come to my organization so that we can help them in San Francisco with asking the family court to make that restraining
order. Your organization is a nonprofit. It's not part of the county.
It is not. We're called the Cooperative Restraining Order Clinic. They call us CROC. I have to say, I know.
I'm not going to make any jokes about that.
Thank you. I will say, I've been at this agency, this is my 17th year, and I feel like at some point, I've been there long enough, we could call it Emberley's Restraining Order Clinic, so it could be E-Rock, which just sounds a little bit better.
Are you the person who's been there the longest, as far as the attorneys are concerned?
Yes.
And you're so young looking.
Thank you, Chuck.
My goodness. So, in that, this program is sent out to a number of stations in California. Is your clinic, although yours is in San Francisco, are there other clinics similar to this or other organizations similar to this in other counties in California? So when you and Judge Hyman talk about these issues, can someone who's not in the San Francisco jurisdiction feel that maybe there's something available to me if I need it?
Absolutely. A mm-hmm. lot of counties, especially here in the Bay Area, have their own restraining order clinics.
Yes.
But throughout the state, there are organizations that can talk with folks about domestic violence restraining orders. If there's not a legal organization in a county, a nonprofit that can help folks with applying for the restraining order, every county has their self-help center mm-hmm. where somebody can go to get help. I still encourage victims before they go to court to file something on their own without mm-hmm. the assistance of an attorney, if there's no attorney to do it, to still talk with a domestic violence advocate or better yet, an attorney who's an expert in domestic violence, to have a conversation first about safety planning. Is a restraining order the next best move for you, or is that something that in your case might actually make things worse?
Safety planning meaning that you can go somewhere where you'll be safe as opposed to being in the home.
Yes, that's part of it, mm-hmm. but also looking at all the different options that are available. Mm-hmm. Maybe the option is to try to get into a shelter. Maybe the option is to wait until the end of the school year when you're going to go visit your mother in another area of the state, and you can take the kids with you at that point, and you'll just be in a safer place to make decisions without the batterer knowing what's going on and being able to monitor you so closely. It's so case by case that it's very important to have that conversation before filing anything at court.
Judge, what about the criminal aspect of this in a protective order? And from the judge's perspective, what do you feel is important here with restraining orders? And you've done it in family court, you've done it in criminal court from Santa Clara County. What thoughts do you have on this?
Well, I agree 100% with Emberley that I've always encouraged people when I was working and in criminal court to also get a restraining order mm-hmm. For a number of reasons. One, because the criminal case could go away. A number of different ways that the case could go away. Probation could end, could be terminated. And depending upon the crime that the person was charged with, one particular crime, the protection order can last 10 years. But rather than getting hung up on the definitions and the actual code sections, I think it's better to have a civil restraining order in addition to the criminal protection order. Also, with respect to the criminal protection order and with respect to the child custody situation, most criminal protection orders defer child custody issues to the family court. It doesn't have to, but that's the better way to go because the family court has family court evaluators and other kinds of people that are trained to hopefully assist the judge in terms of making custody decisions, whereas the criminal judge, number one, doesn't have the time, and number two, for the most part, doesn't have the expertise mm-hmm. to make family law, child custody-related decisions.
Just so that people understand this, generally, people who have not had experience in the court, a judge who's hearing, generally speaking throughout the state, a judge who's hearing a criminal case that may involve some type of a crime where there's a domestic violence involved, and we're talking about a protective order, that particular judge is not then also sitting as a family law judge. Is that correct?
Correct. I believe under law they could. It's mm-hmm. the practice in most courts not to for a number of different reasons. Administratively, it causes problems for courts in terms of getting orders from one location to the next mm-hmm. and files from one location to the next. But one thing that is common if there are children is that a judge issuing a protection order in criminal court will check the box indicating to follow all family court orders, especially if those orders are issued after the protection order. You mm-hmm. don't want to have mm-hmm. them following a family court order that was issued before the protection order.
Why not?
Well, because they made the judge that was issuing that order, that was before the most recent incidents of domestic violence. So that order might be very inappropriate and dangerous. So it needs to be subsequent to the criminal protection order.
Emberly, what is the hardest thing about getting, for someone who's an alleged victim of domestic violence, what's the hardest thing about getting a restraining order?
Really, the hardest thing about getting it is deciding to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The decision to get the restraining order means also making the decision to really leave this relationship. The single most dangerous thing a victim of domestic violence can do is leave the batterer. That's when violence and homicides are so common at that point that we have a term that's been coined for it, separation violence. Mm. That's when the batterer has been saying, if you leave me, I'll kill you. And that's when it happens, after the separation. Mm. So once the person makes that decision that they are going to go get the restraining order, they've made the hardest decision, and now they have to follow all the steps to get it. The hardest procedural part of getting the restraining order at that point is having the other person personally served with the papers, mm-hmm. because they have to be personally served.
And certainly the alleged victim cannot serve the batterer.
Correct.
I say herself, because most of our domestic violence cases have a woman as a victim. Do we not?
Yes.
Still, okay.
Yes.
Do you find, before we went on the air, you were giving me some statistics from San Francisco. Do you find that once a victim of domestic violence is giving some consideration to getting a restraining order, that a very high percentage of those persons kind of don't go forward?
Absolutely. At mm-hmm. my organization, we see between about 900 and 1,000 people a year mm-hmm. who contact us to get some information about the process,
yes.
and we file a much smaller number of restraining orders. That can be because somebody decides they're not ready to leave yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they may start the process, but then decide that it's not something they want to go through with, or they mm-hmm. may not be able to get that person served with the papers. Once we file, if somebody's coming through our organization and we file it and we get to the hearing, almost all of our restraining orders do get granted. The mm-hmm. judges don't agree with me 100% of the time with the mm-hmm. cases, and mm-hmm. I understand that and respect
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the cases that we bring in have enough of a basis for the restraining order that the judges do grant it.
And how effective are these restraining orders through the family court? Can someone rely on them? I mean, you gave me a transcript, Judge, from another county of a tragic situation where this woman who was abused, domestically abused by, I believe, her former husband, went before the judge wanting a restraining order. And the judge, for some reason, and I think this was the third judge in the case, thought she was lying. And it turns out after, and this is a much longer story, it turns out that she was afraid, and this involved the custody, physical custody of their young child, actually, who was quite young. She was very concerned that if her former husband got custody of the child, or visitation, that he might kill the child. And she tried to get the judge to understand that's what was going on, and the judge said, I think you're lying. What judge, can you say with respect to the effectiveness of, and in that case, the judge refused to give a restraining order. generally speaking, what can you say about the most effective way that a judge can deal with someone who is the abuser to try to encourage that person to realize you've just, if there is a restraining order issued, this is something that you've got to do your best to try to follow?
Well, Amberlee indicated the first issue is whether or not a person wants to file. Once it's in court, the next important issue is who's going to be the person that's going to be hearing it. Because if the person doesn't hold the proceedings in a certain way, then even if the order is issued, it may not be followed.
Mm-hmm.
And judges want orders followed. I and my colleagues don't want to set someone up for failure and hope that they violate the order so that we can incarcerate them. That's not what this is all about. Santa Clara County has a death review committee that's met since 1993. And my recollection is that since 1993, one person has been murdered that had a restraining order in place. All the other victims that were murdered since that time period did not. I think that protection orders and restraining orders are extremely important in terms of the process to protect victims and their children. But the issuance of the order in and of itself, without consideration in terms of how the judge conducts the hearing, isn't going to improve outcomes. What improves outcomes is how the judge conducts the hearing. It's extremely important that a judge be polite to both sides, that the judge be perceived by both sides as being fair, neutral, and impartial, which is a very important part of being a judge, and that the judge explain everything in terms of what's going on, how the decision was made, and what the order means. Just giving the order to a restrained person and saying you now have to stay away. In Santa Clara County, it's 300 yards, person, place, residence, mm-hmm. business, mm-hmm. Vehicle, is insufficient. In my view, you have to explain that this is a protection order, this is a restraining order, rather. This is what it means. This is, if you do these things, you'll be in violation of it. Mm-hmm. And these are the possible consequences if you violate the order. I want you to be successful. I don't want you to violate the order. And to the person that has the restraining order, who's the protected person, these are your rights in terms of what you can do to make sure that this order is enforced should it be violated. I'm hoping that it's not going to be violated.
So if the restraining order is violated by the abuser, what should the alleged victim do at
call
that
the
point.
Police immediately.
I see. Okay.
And the police have been trained to take these matters very seriously. And I can just about guarantee you, because the law has changed, the criminal response has changed, a violation of restraining order no longer has to occur in the presence of a peace officer.
Mm-hmm.
A number of years ago, before that law changed, the police officer would take a report, the DA's office would go the complaint route, get an arrest warrant from a judge. Or the other option was to have the victim actually make a citizen's arrest.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good thing.
No.
We want to, as much as possible, eliminate the victim from the equation in terms of making arrests. It's a lot to ask of them to even call the police, but obviously someone needs to do that. So the police officer, if he or she has probable cause to believe that a restraining order or a protection order were violated and that the person who was restrained violated it, it's a misdemeanor, even if not committed in the presence, and the police officer, upon finding the person, can make the arrest. And mm-hmm. if the person has a prior conviction for violation of these orders, at the discretion of the prosecutor, can be filed as a felony.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing is that this happens as quickly as possible. And then when it goes to criminal court, because it'll be filed on, in terms of the consequences, it depends upon what the person has done. What judges are most concerned about, and prosecutors, the police, and in victims, advocates, is if the person actually appeared at the place It's a less serious violation, but still a violation if there were calls that were made, texting, emails, those kinds of things. We certainly want to discourage that. There certainly needs to be appropriate consequences for that. But the most serious violation is if the person actually shows up
physically. Shows up at the place.
Because that's...
within that 300 yards that you're talking about, at least in Santa Clara County.
Right. That's how homicides happen, when people show up. So that's got to be taken extremely seriously.
Yes.
And the consequences for that on the criminal side are going to be very serious.
And I want to add, it can be very frustrating for a victim to call the police, but the restrained person disappears before the police show up.
Sure, of course.
And if they call over and over and over when this is happening, the police get frustrated too.
Sure.
The police want to be able to catch somebody, and they keep getting called out to the same place, and the person's already gone. So then the victim, it's this vicious cycle. Then the victim thinks, oh, I don't want to bother the police, or oh, the police are getting frustrated.
That's when it starts to get very dangerous,
I would think,
or potentially dangerous.
And the victim needs to keep calling, though. Mm-hmm. If there's a restraining order in place, they need to keep calling every time it's violated so that paper trail is there, so that when the person is slow that 17th time,
trips and falls down.
Exactly. Then the police catch them that time. Yeah. We've got police reports for all those other times. The DA can charge each of those violations, the person.
Let me do this. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about domestic violence and restraining orders against abusers, both in the family law context as well as the criminal law context. My guests are Judge Eugene Hyman of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, retired, and coordinating attorney Emberly Cross of the Cooperative Restraining Order Clinic in San Francisco. For those of you who may have some questions or comments or whatever, we will be taking some calls in the second half hour of the program if you are able to hear the live program. And for those of you who are maybe out of the area and are listening to us on the internet at www.kalw.org, you will also be able to call in. Let me just ask you a couple more questions, because we're getting to just a few minutes left of the statewide version of the program, which we do send out. And that is, we've talked about how the court should address the abuser, to try to get some good communication with the abuser, that I want you to succeed, et cetera, et cetera. What if we find that, for example, in the restraining order, the issuance of the order, that the abuser is really doing very well, but cannot, let's say the order says you are to stay away from the home, et cetera, et cetera. You are not to have custody or visitation rights with the children, et cetera. What about a modification of the order? How difficult is that to get, and what is needed?
If it's in the family law context, either party can at any time go ahead and file a request to modify the order. You have to give the other party notice that you're doing that. We actually have a new statute that went into effect that made it very specific that if you're the restrained person trying to get the order set aside or modified, you have to prove to the court that there's been personal service of that request to the person to be protected, because we want to make sure the protected person knows that somebody's asking that this restraining order go away. You go back in front of the judge and explain to the judge why you want it set aside or modified, and it's up to the judge whether or not to do that. If it's the person requesting, if it's the protected person who wants to go in and get it set aside or have it modified to allow more contact with the restrained party, the courts give a lot of deference to that. It's not like the criminal side where it's the people's case, it's the prosecutor going forward with the case. In the family law context, if one person went in there and asked for an order and now they want to get rid of it or change it, the courts defer, and in my experience, they generally do go ahead and appropriately do what the protected person is asking.
Let me come back to you and the statistics that you both gave me off the air in just a few minutes ago, where a much smaller number of the persons who, let's say, have been domestically abused really follow through. What recommendations do you have for those persons, the primarily women who have been probably domestically abused more than once, maybe many times? Perhaps there's a power and control issue here. Perhaps the woman is thinking, well, it's my fault. I'm just not patient enough with him. He works hard, et cetera, et cetera. Because in doing programs like this that I have over the years, frequently I will hear that the abused victim feels that, and it's usually women, feels that they are at fault. What recommendations do you have for a woman who, let's say, has called the police, has gotten at least a temporary restraining order, maybe has come to your clinic or wherever she may be to look into getting a not just a temporary restraining order, but one of more permanency, and then she decides that, well, gee, I'm not sure I want to do this to him. What recommendations do you have?
If she feels like she's not ready to go forward, then I respect that and say our door is always open if you want to come back another time. And then I would encourage her to try to find whatever support she can, whether that's calling a crisis line in San Francisco. The 24-hour crisis line for domestic violence survivors is run by Woman Inc. That's 415-864-4722. Again,
is that just in San Francisco?
They will answer calls from any place.
Really?
Yes, but that is the
organization. That's Women Inc.
Woman Inc. It stands for Women Organized to Make Abuse Non-Existent.
I see. I have never heard of that.
So to reach out to the crisis line if that feels like a safe thing to do, to find out what other resources are available, whether that's going to a support group or meeting with one-on-one with a counselor to talk about options and safety planning and to think about what the best move is for you and your kids, and to know that it's not your fault. No matter what the batterer is saying, nobody ever deserves to be abused. It's never okay for somebody to put their hands on you in a violent manner. It's just never okay.
Judge, we've got 30 seconds.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Emberly said. Judges in the civil context, restraining orders are going to give a great deal of deference in terms of what a victim wants. The possible exceptions is if you're aware of the criminal case, if there was one, and if the victims received horrible injuries, then a judge might require prior to the dismissal that she has to talk to a victim advocate and receive safety planning. In the criminal case, not as much deference is going to be given to the wants of a victim, but in a civil case, a great deal. But it's really important that that this is a willing decision and that the victim isn't being coerced into making these changes. Also, there needs to be a overall community safety plan to make sure that in the event that a bad decision is made in one division of the court regarding an order, that there's other avenues that are available to make it safe.
It is about 727 and a half at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on family law focusing on domestic violence, restraining orders against abusers. I welcome you. This is a difficult, obviously, a very, very difficult area for persons who may be victims of abuse. It's probably also very difficult for those who are the abusers. I would hope that those of you who unfortunately have been involved in something like this, if you have questions, comments, had some experience with a court or whatever, join us with your questions, your comments, please. 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134 is the number. If you're out of the area and listening to us on the internet at www.klw.org, that is also the same number to call, 1-415-841-4134. For those of you who are wondering when is our next Call a Lawyer night, it will be next week, June 27th, and you might want to jot down the number. It's 1-800-525-9917. On the program, we will do landlord-tenant law with Coy Driscoll and Mark Seidenfeld. So I see that there are no calls yet, and that's not unusual in a topic like this. And all I can say to you is I encourage you, if you have a question, a comment, if you had a good experience in the court or a bad experience in the court, join us, if you would, with your comments, your questions, perhaps your criticisms, whatever you feel comfortable in doing. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. For a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-4444. 1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. That number is 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. Also, if you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. You should be able to find that there's a live person to talk to. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced for you and set up a half-an-hour consultation. The cost, depending on the county, for a half-an-hour could be a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. So it's a great way to try to get some basic information about what your rights and obligations may be. My guests are Coordinating Attorney Amber Lee Cross of the Cooperative Restraining Order Clinic in San Francisco and Judge Eugene Hyman of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, retired. And I welcome you to join me. There is a question that was brought in to the studio here. Is it typical for an alleged abuser to be criminally prosecuted if the victim does not cooperate? And let me continue. This goes on, and I'll repeat it if you ask. Does the DA's office usually pursue domestic violence charges based only on the complaint of friends or neighbors, as what happened in the case of Sheriff Ross McAreamy?
As to the first part of the question, if it's typical for somebody to be criminally prosecuted by the DA's office if the victim's not cooperating, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that harkens back to a time, luckily many years ago, when victims would reach out to the police and nothing would happen. We hear that stereotypical, the police just told him to take a walk around the block and nothing happened. As a result of that vacuum of a response, laws were passed that required certain actions to be taken and took away some discretion from mm-hmm. law enforcement mm-hmm. and from judges and from prosecutors. And now there are some things that have to be done. And certainly took, as Judge Hyman was saying earlier, took the burden off of the victim to say, I want this case to be prosecuted, because the person then that the abuser is going to get mad at is the victim, because mm-hmm. the victim was the one who decided this was going to happen. So that decision has been taken completely out of the hands of victims, and it's now up to the district attorney's office, to the prosecutor's office, to decide whether to prosecute.
And certainly, even if the victim communicates to the district attorney's office, I don't want this to be prosecuted, she, if this is a woman, does not control what the DA's office will do.
Absolutely. The DA's office can go forward in a case without the victim. That's what they do.
Yes.
If the case goes along, if this domestic violence escalates to become a domestic violence homicide, the DA's office is going to have to go forward without the victim.
Yeah.
So they go forward without the victim before it reaches that level.
As a matter of fact, the police and prosecution are trained how to bring a victimless case mm-hmm. to prosecute, because it's more common than not that a victim recants or in some way does not want to participate. So that's very common.
All right, let's take some calls. Joanna, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for calling.
Of course. I know you've been talking about physical abuse. I was once in a verbally abusive relationship that I think was more destructive to me than physical abuse. Can the police ever get involved in where there's really extreme verbal abuse? And is there ever been a restraining order in that situation?
That's a very good question.
And what I find from a lot of survivors I've talked with is they tell me the bruises heal, a broken bone even heals, but the names that you've been called for so many years, that's the part that it's really hard to recover from. That's the part that just sticks with you for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still domestic violence, whether there's physical violence or not, when somebody's using these different tactics to maintain power and control over their intimate partner. That's domestic violence. The law can't always get involved in those situations, mm-hmm. though. To go in and ask the family court to make a domestic violence restraining order, you have to be able to show the judge that there's been physical violence, sexual violence, threats of great bodily injury, or really severe harassment. And quite often, the verbal abuse, unless it's threats, mm-hmm. threats of physical injury, quite often that's not enough that the judge can make a restraining order. Their hands are tied.
Do you have any comments on that, Jess, since you sat on the family court also?
I totally agree with what Emily just said. The only thing I would add is that while a restraining order may not be able to issue, these are important matters to take into consideration with respect to custody,
yes.
Custody decisions with respect to children, if there are, in fact, children.
Yes.
And depending upon how often it's happening and what the circumstances are, this might wind up in neglect and abuse court, juvenile dependency court. But certainly it's important information that a judge wants to know about with respect to any time a custody decision is to be made.
Okay. Well, Joanna, thank you very much for calling. Jerry, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Are you there?
It's Barry.
I'm sorry. Pardon me, Barry.
It's all right. I got a lousy phone.
Well, no, you sound good now. The phone sounds good. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you very much. You know, gosh, I don't want to sound like a spoiler on this. I really support the need for these kind of programs because people do suffer often in silence for too long, and they do need help. And it does give the police a tool to act on immediately if someone has a history of this kind of thing against a particular person. Now, my father... I'm an older person now. I'm in my late 20s. My father was given a TRO from, with my aunt.
Temporary restraining order.
Yeah, yeah. And I think in this case, it was in California. And it was, he's a minor and he works in Canada and mostly in Montana. And a lot of places, he doesn't get mail every day. He's got to go out and rent a box and go through the snow, get his mail. They weren't able to serve him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't get served. And he was going through a divorce. And that seems to be what was going on because his ex-wife was a friend of this aunt of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And this TRO seems to be what it was. It's expired now. She came in and got it dismissed on, I think, advice from his family divorce attorney.
But the temporary restraining order was as to whom? The your mother or who?
My father. It was against my father.
Oh, obviously. I know. But who was the protected, who was the alleged victim?
My aunt. And
why is that?
I got a copy. What? Say that again?
Why was it your aunt and not your mother?
Oh. it was my aunt, it wasn't my mother. It was my aunt, and she had said that he had gone in and threatened the life of her son.
I see.
In that effect. And it was just a verbal claim. And of course, a judge doesn't know everything. So in order to get this person protected, she got the order. And then the 90 days went out just before the 90 days expired. She went in and got it. But he didn't even know that this thing was out there.
Your dad did not know?
No.
Okay.
No, he did not know. And and that's the only reason why he didn't know is his divorce lawyer didn't tell him. My dog's trying to get my attention.
Okay. Your point is Barry, that your father was never personally served, and that was defunct situation.
Ironically, he has because he worked with explosives, he has a high security clearance in his mining job, and now this TRO is kind of blemish on his background. He has no violence history or criminal.
So, Barry, we've got other people who want to talk. Did you have a question that you wanted to pose?
Well, if you can show that one of these orders is instead actually an act of maliciousness or something, harassment, what can a person do? Is that, that's my question.
All right. Let me... Let me try to get some comments for you. Turn your radio back up, would you, Barry? Because
thank you. I'll take my answer off the phone.
If you would, because your phone keeps doing some funny thing from time to time. Go ahead, Emberly.
I can take a try at this. When going to the family court to ask the judge to make a domestic violence restraining order, there are two stages to that process. The first stage is going in and filing your request and asking the judge to make a temporary restraining order. That lasts for a short period of time until a hearing when the judge decides whether to make a longer order. An order in California, a domestic violence order from family court at the hearing can be made for up to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times the temporary order gets issued, but you get to the hearing and the judge finds that there's not enough evidence to grant the order, and then there's no restraining order after hearing. So if somebody had a temporary order made against them and the order was not granted at the hearing, I think you could explain that to somebody who had a question about it. If somebody felt like that was a blemish on their employment record or something like that, and they were asked about it in an interview or in some context where it mattered, they could explain that this person went in and filed a written request for a restraining order against me before even having a hearing. The judge read that request, assumed that there was what was in there was true, granted a temporary order. But then at the hearing, when I had an opportunity to respond, the judge found that there was no basis for an order and denied it.
And here, however, his father, Barry's father, apparently never at the time that this was going on didn't know about it, but there's something on the record, and he's concerned about it being on the record, and if he has a security clearing, what would that do to him? What comments do you have on that, anything, Judge Hyman?
Well, we're not really talking about a domestic violence restraining order since the relationship test wasn't here. This is more of an harassment order than it's a restraining order. But in any event, the legal principles are the same in that he wasn't served.
Yeah.
And if he wasn't served, then the court doesn't have jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And if an order was issued, then he'd have to come in when he became aware of it and set it aside based upon the fact that he wasn't served.
He could presumably retain an attorney, file some kind of a motion, and have it...
And then a judge would decide if the evidence there was sufficient proof that he wasn't served. And if that was the case, then the court was without jurisdiction to issue it in the first place, and it would be set aside.
Yeah. Okay, Barry, that's maybe something you can communicate to your father. Mary, welcome to Your Legal Rights, and let me do this before you start your question. This is Your Legal Rights, and the number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. Mary, welcome.
Hi. I'm so happy that you have a program like this. Because there's a lot of people that we don't know.
Mary, stop for a moment. Is your radio... Turn your radio down, would you? We're getting an echo.
Okay, you're
stuck. Yep. Okay, yeah, because I don't want to get the echo. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
So this happened a long time ago, and I was going to say that long time ago, my English was... I mean, I couldn't speak English at all long time ago. And so I had to go from one place to another place, because my daughter's dad was making my life miserable. So then I decided to move from, like I said, from one place to another place. And he gave my records on the DMV. So he followed me. And then after, I don't know how many months after that, he get together with this lady. But the lady, she was working for a lawyer or something like that. And anyways, one time they came, and it was not only one time, but the first time they came, they kicked me out of my apartment, and it was like three ladies. And so they hit me and everything, and I was by myself. So I called the police, and I started, you know, screaming like, call the police. So when the police came, the police first asked them what happened, and they listened to them because the police didn't speak Spanish.
The police did not speak Spanish, and you spoke Spanish, but you did not speak English.
Yes.
So if you would try to get to the point that you're trying to make, would you?
Okay, so then the lady, because she was working for an attorney, she sent me a lot of papers, and they was harassing me all the time. And He was really, really bad. And she sent me like a subpoena order in San Francisco, subpoena order here in Berkeley, and well, it was Oakland, and then in Monterey, different court orders, different times, and same days. So I don't know what happened to them, but I don't see them a long, long, long time.
Okay, but what I'm sorry, Mary, you've gone over many areas. What is your question or what is your point?
Okay, my question is, because he's working in a cash, he's getting a cash, so he doesn't report that he makes money. So that's any way, can I still have the child support or?
Oh, you're not talking about domestic violence. You're talking about child support. Is that correct?
Well, in the beginning, I was talking about domestic violence.
Oh my. Okay, listen. we cannot do all of the issues in your case. Do you have?
Now is the point about child support.
Okay, no, we're not going to talk about child support on this program. Let me suggest this to you, if you don't mind. We will be doing next week, if you've listened to this program before, we will be doing Call a Lawyer Night. And I will have, as one of the lawyers who you can speak to off the air, a family lawyer. So if you have a question regarding child support, I would ask if you would, please, to wait until next week, next Wednesday, the 27th. And do you have something to write down with? I'll give you the phone number to call.
Yes.
Do you have something? Okay. For Call a Lawyer, and that'll start at 7 o'clock next Wednesday. It's 1-800-525-9917. 800-525-9917. And if you do have some questions, including child support or child custody, then certainly call next week and ask to speak to the family lawyer.
Okay, can I ask you one question about domestic violence?
Well, if you would really be succinct.
Really okay.
Try to get right to the before,
and it was a restraining order. Take me a while to decide to do it.
Yes.
But I don't know for how long is good the restraining order.
Well, when did you get the restraining order? How long ago?
That's years ago.
Last year. Okay. And this is in the family court in San Francisco?
No, in Oakland.
In Oakland, in Alameda County. So you're wondering how long the restraining order lasts?
Yes.
And you don't have an attorney in your case, is that right?
I'm sorry?
You do not have an attorney representing you in the case?
Yeah, that's right.
You do not. You're on your own. Let me get Amberlee to try to respond to you. Amberlee, obviously, most of her work is in San Francisco, but perhaps she can give you some direction. Could you turn your radio back up and get the answer from the radio? Would you do that? Okay, go ahead, Amberlee. Yeah.
Hi, Mary. So hopefully
I'm sorry. Yeah, Mary, go ahead.
So when you went to court, Mary, to get that restraining order, hopefully you walked out with a physical copy of it in your hands. If you've still got that, you can take a look at the first page, and about three quarters of the way down, it's going to have a date that says when it expired. If you did not walk out of court with that, you should go back to the court. And probably, if you were in Oakland, you're probably going to go to the courthouse in Alameda for the restraining orders. That's going to be either in Alameda or down in Hayward if you're in South County. And go in there to ask for a copy of the order from the file so that you can take a look at it and see what that is. You should have a copy of it anyway so that if it's being violated, you can call the police and show that to them so that they can enforce it for you.
Let me ask you this. Most counties have an office called a family law facilitator.
Yes.
Is that somewhere that she could go to see if they can give her some help on something like this?
Absolutely, because in her county, they could tell her what office to go to. They might even be able to look it up on their computer, and maybe they'll even be able to print out a copy of it from their computer.
So, Mary, the point of this is, if you haven't become familiar with that office, in most counties, it's called the Family Law Facilitator's Office. They can be very helpful in family law issues, and what you need to do is contact Alameda County and ask if you can speak to someone in the family law facilitator's office. You're probably going to have to go in there personally and see if they can help you, but you can start by giving them a call. And good luck to you. Our number is 1-415-841-4134. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, so earlier this year, I was in court with one of my girlfriends who asked for a restraining order and against her boyfriend, and he asked for one against her. And the judge granted the restraining order to protect my friend, but then said that he was also going to grant a restraining order against my friend to protect the boyfriend, but the order wasn't, like, it was a different kind of restraining order, but it was still some kind of order. And so we were both confused.
Of what it was,
About, you know, about why, you know, my friend had evidence of text messages and threats, and the judge, you know, her boyfriend didn't have any kind of evidence, but the judge said he just wanted to...
What county, Kelly, was this in?
San Francisco.
San Francisco. Amberly, if you would.
Sure. It sounds like the two different types of orders that these folks got, one is probably what we call a CLETS order, and one is what I would call a non-CLETS order. CLETS stands for the California Law Enforcement Telecommunications System. A CLETS order is going to be on a court form down on the bottom in bold and capital letters. It's going to say those letters, CLETS. And if you have a restraining order that says CLETS down at the bottom, you know that that goes into the police computer system. If you have to call 911 because it's being violated, the information about the restraining order pops up on the computer screen of the 911 call taker. If you call the police, they can look it up in their car. And a person can be arrested for violating a CLETS order. Sometimes judges will make what we call a non-CLETS order, which is still a court order telling somebody what to do or what not to do, but it does not go into the CLETS system. It's on a different form entirely. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say CLETS at the bottom. So the police don't arrest somebody for violating that non-CLETS order.
So you think the order that the boyfriend got against Kelly's friend may have been that non-CLETS order.
That's what possibly. It sounds like.
Yeah. Well, also, it's very unusual to have that kind of a situation because under the law, a judge cannot enter mutual restraining orders without there actually being a hearing. So it can't be entered by stipulation. There actually has to be a hearing. Now, the issuance of non-CLETS orders, as Amberly has described, is one of these situations which is a local practice kind of thing. Personally, I think it's a bad idea. I think you're sending the wrong message.
Yeah.
And sometimes a judge, and especially if one of the parties or both of the parties have lawyers, it's sort of splitting the difference, issuing one order and then issuing a partial other order just to sort of make people happy. It's a big mistake. Judges are there to make decisions. You either issue the order or you don't, but you don't compromise, and that's my personal view.
Okay, all right. And then we have our next person is Anonymous. And Anonymous, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. So I was arrested back in December 2012 because my brother and my husband got into a fight at our house, and I stepped in to kind of intervene, and I slapped my husband, and he got upset, and like an hour later called the police, and I was arrested because you're not allowed to hit people. So basically, I mean, and we were all drinking. So, and my brother was here, and he had left by the time the cops came, but he lived next door, and supposedly the police went over there to try to find him, but they never questioned him. So they took up both of our statements, and I was taken away, and then I came back, and we're okay. We're just trying to move. This case has just been going on and on. They finally got the evidence sent to the lawyer that I have hired. And he went to court today, and the DA wants to continue to prosecute. And my husband does not want to prosecute. He has, you know, stated that, but it doesn't really matter because I'm, you know, it's the state against me at this point. So I've been hearing that supposedly, like, I don't know about too much about anything about this because I've never been arrested before. This was all just a really crazy night, and it just exploded. And I just am curious, like, if we go to court, if my husband doesn't testify and the DA can't get him to, you know, state what happened and he tells the story about what really happened about this fight because the police didn't really write it down right in the report, do they have a case against me still?
Are you represented by an attorney, Anonymous?
Yes.
You know, you're asking for a legal opinion, which the state bar's ethics rules don't permit my guests to give. But let me ask them to, instead of giving you a legal opinion, give you something that maybe you can take and maybe help you understand what's going on. Do either of you have anything to say that would be of some assistance to Anonymous?
Well, if she doesn't feel that the crime occurred, then she needs to take it to trial, and a jury of her peers will listen to the evidence and decide. Mm-hmm. The prosecutor has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. If the husband won't testify, and if the brother won't testify, and assuming that they can't be compelled to testify because they can't be found or whatever, then that would be insufficient evidence.
Okay, great. And so when you get subpoenaed, I mean, do you get subpoenaed to come in to court? And if you can just choose not to show
up? No. If you're subpoenaed, you have to show.
No.
But they have to have a criminal subpoena requires personal service. They can't serve someone else. They have to serve actually you. And if they don't serve you, then you're not obligated to appear. But if you're obligated to appear, and, you know, a judge, if a person wants to rely upon their Fifth Amendment or something like that, then an attorney will be appointed to represent them if they can't afford one.
Okay.
I suggest, Anonymous, that if you haven't discussed this at length with your attorney, you should. So good luck to you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much for calling. Here's the last question that comes from someone who called it in. And this is significant, and we have very little time left. If a hunter has a restraining order against him or her, whoever this is, does the hunter have to surrender his or her rifle?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's part of the law.
During the pendency of the restraining order, a person may not have under their care, custody, or control any firearm. Period.
Or ammunition.
Ammunition. And they may not try to obtain one during this period. And if they've been convicted of a domestic violence crime, then under California law, they lose the privilege for 10 years. Under federal law, they lose the privilege for life.
So there you are. That's the answer to that. I want to thank you both very much for joining us
on
the program. Very nice to have you. By the way, for those of you who are interested, next week, June 27th, is our Call a Lawyer night. I hope you can join us. 1-800-525-9917. You can talk to one of many attorneys off the air while we're doing the program, which is going to be on landlord-tenant law with my guests James Coy Driscoll and Mark Seidenfeld on the air. I want to thank you very much, Coordinating Attorney Amber Lee Cross of the Cooperative Restraining Order Clinic in San Francisco.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
And Judge Eugene Hyman of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, retired. Very nice
thank
to have you,
you
back
thank
on
you
the
for
program.
Inviting me.
Great to have you here. Your Legal Rights staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. I hope you have gotten something out of this program and that you will join us for Call a Lawyer, which is next week, 1-800-525-9917. I'm Chuck Finney.
Bye.